For great-looking t-shirts, hoodies, and sweatshirts, the TNT Shop is now open at tntradio.live. Damian Richardson on today's News Talk. TNT Radio.
Welcome to the show on Wednesday, the 3rd of May. Sometimes they say, when they introduce me, they say, Damian Richardson, telling the truth, telling it like it is. Well, the reality is I have to accept the truth now that this sedentary lifestyle of being presenter on radio is making me fat. Not doing any exercise, not doing enough exercise. When I was working in construction, at least I was working out a different muscle group every day. But now it's no longer, I can't deny it. For a while, you can sort of deny it. Say, oh, that's not too bad. You can suck it in a little bit. Ah, it's still fine. It's fine. It's fine. But it's undeniable now. It's undeniable that I'm going to have to start trying to do some more exercise. I had the ex-boss actually of the construction ring me up a couple of days ago. I rang him back the very next day just to see what was going on. He said, oh, it's all right. It was a pocket call. Oh, okay. Thanks very much. I miss you too. I thought I might get a bit of work on the weekends or something as a means to do some exercise. And he said, how's the show going? I said, yeah, it's going good. Thanks. He said, I haven't been able to get it. Can't use the internet suddenly. I think we know what that meant. I think that means he's maybe not ideologically predisposed to some of the things I talk about. He said one of the school teachers used to get on pretty well with when we're working in this construction site. He said one of the school teachers has been tuning in. He said to me, didn't realize he was so right wing. But his wife loves the show. His wife's now listening to it. So, g'day, school teacher. Let's just call him Bruce. You'll know who you are, just, you know, to protect his anonymity. G'day, Bruce's wife. I hope you're listening in now, and I hope you are enjoying the airwaves. Talking of fat, I was thinking, well, what am I going to do about my editorial? I thought, I can talk about, you know, the grotesquerie that I am turning into sitting in front of a microphone every single day. But also, I got a phone call from someone from the Victorian Energy Upgrade Program, Rose. Indian accent she had, Rose. She was talking to me. She was very nice to me. And Rose said she would like to help me get some water-saving shower roses that the government were happy to support. Did I have my shower roses yet? I said, well, I've got my shower roses, yes. I'm using them on a daily basis, but I don't necessarily have the water-saving ones. And she said she'd be quite happy to make an appointment, but she got the wrong postcode. She got the postcode I was living in about 10 years ago. So she said, well, when we come to your area, your postcode, we'd be happy to install these shower roses. And I thought, how's that going to work? I mean, are they going to have the aesthetic quality of the shower roses I've got? I mean, there's some aesthetics going on in my bathrooms. There's two of them. There's one upstairs. No, actually, there's three. Oh, my God, my daughter's got an ensuite. I forgot. I've told her incorrect amount of shower roses I will need. I told her four. I'm going to need six. I'll have to get back to Rose. She didn't leave a number. But she said she come from the Green World Service. Green World Service. You can imagine what that means. They've obviously been franchised out by the Victorian government. We're all paying for these shower roses. But I'm thinking this, what shower roses are they going to just apply? Some shower rose that's not going to match my decor at all, just going to slap it on? Or they got a selection of shower roses? Is the taxpayer paying for a selection of shower roses? It reminds me, my grandfather was a bit of a handyman. He loves to stick a shower rose on. He'd just find one he had lying around in the shed and he'd stick it onto the bathroom. And the women in the family just said, no way, mate. Do it in some bathroom that you're using out the back near his sleep out. That's fine. There's no way you're applying that inside the house. It's got no aesthetic value whatsoever. He couldn't understand it, of course, but he did what he was told in that respect. And I'm thinking, is that what's going to happen here too? Surely the government's going to try and apply these shower roses. It's just going to be an absurdity. As always, these government programs ending up being an absurdity. They don't just offer shower roses, though. They offer LED lighting, which can be installed for free as well, and door shields. Plastic door shields to sit underneath the bottom of the door to stop the draft escaping. So, you know, the warmth stays in. That's fine. But do you really need the government to go out and buy door shields for the whole of Victoria, as it turns out in this case? And I'd imagine it'd be for the whole of Australia ultimately as well. What happened to the snake? You know, that snake, that knitted snake stuffed with seeds and stuff that you'd get, you know, my grandmother's friends used to knit at the bowls club. You'd get one in team colours if you want. You just put that by the door. That stops the wind going out. That's been stopping the wind, you know, the draft from escaping since millennia, since women started knitting. But no, we need special door shields now, don't we, supported by the government so they can show us how green they're being, how green their credentials are. There's also a power monitoring device I could have if I wanted. I could monitor my power monitoring device that the government would supply me with through Green World Service, through the Victorian Energy Upgrade Program. They're saying these things, new energy is making everything cheaper, but I've got to wonder if it really is making anything cheaper with all these incentives that are being offered at the same time. And then just before I was about to come to air, I got another phone call, this time from someone representing the federal government. They said they would give me a rebate of up to $6,000 if I was to install some solar panels. Solar panels. I said, I've already got some. I said, they just heat the hot water. He said, no, no, sir. No, no. He was Indian as well. He said, no, sir. No, you can have them to put electricity into the whole house. And I said, okay, Sam. His name was Sam, of course. His anglicized name. I'm sure Sam's going to, and his people are going to ring me back tomorrow, make an appointment so I can have a solar panel expert talk to me exactly about the needs I will have in my house to electrify it with a rebate from the government of up to $6,000. And you wonder why, you know, renewable energy is so much cheaper, than the coal-fired or gas-fired power station. Anyway. That's my first rant. Stand by, of course, in the second hour for rant number two. Did you know there are many ways you can listen to TNT Radio? Why not stream us direct from our website on your desktop, tablet, or mobile device, or download our app from the App Store? We even stream live on YouTube, Rumble, and Odyssey. We've got you covered, of course, on TNT Radio.
Unbiased and reliable news coverage.
It's the news I trust.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
The Western Australian government has been slammed by the State Auditor General for the way it managed the purchase of rapid, I'm talking of government waste, rapid antigen tests in the name of COVID-19. TNT Radio News producer Jeremy Beck has details on this story. Jeremy, you are reading my mind yet again. We've been working together for too long, 3 months, we're already symbiotic.
It seems like that, Damien. Well, in her report released today, Western Australia's Auditor General, Caroline Spencer, says the rapid escalation in cost of the rapid antigen tests to $580 million in total is unlike anything she has ever seen. She says that what started out as a $3 million spend on tests for health workers and returning travellers quickly spiraled beyond $440 million, around twice the cost of the Bunbury Hospital redevelopment. She added public entities spent the equivalent of 10% of the state's 2022 operating surplus on diagnostic plastics without demonstrable evidence of clear, considered and coordinated planning or ongoing advice as to the necessity of the expenditure. I acknowledge the uncertainty that the pandemic created. However, I have never before witnessed such escalation in the cost of a program over such a short time frame, occurring with a lack of due consideration of the impacts or without a record of anyone pausing to ask what level of procurement was sufficient and whether this had been achieved. Now, what is the response from the government? Well, the agency Health Support Services of WA Health defended itself, saying a time was of the essence to secure and purchase rapid antigen tests for Western Australia with our borders about to reopen. So I think it's all coming out in the open. What a big waste of money a lot of these programs were, Damien.
Spending too much money on diagnostics plastics, Jeremy. The bureaucraties is enough to beguile. These tests came home with my children for a couple of years, basically, or at least 18 months, rapid antigen tests, a packet every week, three children at three schools. They were just banking up. I had a shelf devoted to these tests. These tests were never used, but they continued to turn up, and now we find out exactly at what cost. Not free at all. Is there any way this money could have been better spent, or maybe not spent at all, Jeremy?
I think hardly spent it all. Perhaps we could have used a few rapid antigen tests at, say, some nursing homes or what have you, in some select areas where there are vulnerable people. That's fair enough. We've had experts talking about this issue. Ivor Cummins comes to mind, and he's a big skeptic on the whole COVID issues, and he was a big one for using the rapid antigen tests over the PCR tests, he said, which are pretty useless, but in select circumstances. But we're talking about $1.6 billion that the Australian government invested on the rapid antigen tests. And that's the Western Australian one was just alone nearly $600 million. Yes, it sure could have been better spent, probably mostly not at all on that, just growing our economy, which would actually improve our health if we had jobs and just a contented Australians. That's a good thing for health, not a sick economy, which creates sick people.
So you're talking about Western Australia, but specifically of $580, million dollars spent on this?
Yeah.
What about the whole of Australia? Have you got any idea on how much money has been spent on these PCR tests?
I haven't checked the exact figures, but to the PCR tests on top of the rapid antigen tests, absolute fortune. We're talking obviously billions of dollars. I must admit, I'll let you into a little secret, Damien. I have not had one PCR test and not one rapid antigen test in the last few years. I refuse to take it, and I've done fine. I haven't felt sick at all in the last few years. And I haven't taken the jabs. I think if more people did that, we would be a hell of a lot better.
I think I probably knew that secret already, Jeremy. I think next time you tell me a secret, just make it a little bit more interesting for us, you know, me and the listeners. Jeremy Beck, news producer, thanks so much for that story. You are listening to TNT Radio.
You should hear what Lynn Shaw is talking about.
So right now, the Earn It Act I've been talking about it for a long time, just reintroduced into Congress, and it stands for, because I want you to have a clear understanding, eliminating abusive and rampant neglect of interactive technologies. It revises the federal framework governing the prevention of online sexual exploitation of children. It is out of control. It is the Wild West online. I know you know this because we all know it now, and we're hearing more and more about it each and every day. So this bill, the Earn It, would establish the National Commission on Online Child Sexual Exploitation Prevention, and the commission would develop best practices for interactive computer services that would be, you know, Facebook, Twitter, to prevent, reduce, and respond quickly to online sexual exploitation of children.
Lynn Shaw on TNT Radio.
In times of fear, World Vision has been there for the most vulnerable. For the last 70 years, we've stood with kids and families during some of the world's hardest times. Through natural disasters, war, and disease, delivering life-saving aid and support, helping rebuild lives, and empowering entire communities to lift themselves out of poverty. And we're doing the same today. Because rising to these challenges is in our DNA. And with every act of courage, faith, and love, at home and abroad, we do more than just stop the spread of fear. We replace it with hope. Learn more at worldvision.org.
And now a news update. The president's doctor has confirmed that the president is suffering from gastric distress. Apparently, he can't stop Putin.
You're stupid.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
I was pretty excited when I got onto this guest. I thought I got a new guest for the show. It's going to be great. I've done my research on him. I thought this guy's going to be fantastic. I rang him up, had a chat to him a couple of days ago. And he said, yeah, I've been on TNT Radio before. Deflated, absolutely deflated. But he hasn't been on TNT Radio for a while, and he's got more to add to the conversation. It is, of course, David Truman. He's an educator and writer and director of the Freedom and Heritage Society. And his latest article on that website is A Trojan Horse for Co-Governance, which is about voice to the Australian Parliament, of course. David Truman, welcome back to the show, or to my show for the first time.
Hello?
Hello, David?
I had to change the handset. Go on.
Oh, did you? Good. Okay, I will. Now, just introduce you, David, in case you didn't hear that. I was interested you. Well, I was talking to you the other day, and I know this is in your article too. You talk about the Treaty of Waitangi, because I know I've had so many New Zealanders tell me throughout the throughout my lifetime, oh, my God, Australia really is, you know, not cutting the mustard. It's so much better in New Zealand because we had this Treaty of Waitangi signed in 1940 with the Maori people. But it's not all it's necessarily cracked up to be, is it?
Well, no. The Treaty of Waitangi was negotiated in the Maori language in 1840 between Captain Hobson and the Maori chiefs. New Zealand worked quite well over a century on the basis of equality between the Maori people and the British and other people in New Zealand, on the basis that the Maori chiefs surrendered their sovereignty to the British Crown and got in exchange equal treatment under British common law. And that worked out quite well. The problem with what's been happening in New Zealand much more recently is that in 1975 a New Zealand Maori minister brought in a fraudulent Treaty of Waitangi Act 1975, which was based on an incorrect translation of the Treaty of Waitangi, into which he had put some flowery words for the benefit of the British Crown, which weren't in the original language in which the treaty was negotiated. And he inserted words like, Her Majesty the Queen of England confirms and guarantees to the chiefs, blah, 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 undisturbed possession of their lands and estates, forests and fisheries and other properties, and so on. Now, that reference to lands and estates, forests and fisheries was not in the original treaty, and that has been used by the Maori iwi, the Maori elite, as a basis for claiming and in fact plundering the resources that belong to all the people of New Zealand. And the Treaty of Waitangi Act and its subsequent amendment have been used to install co-governance in New Zealand. And that was never the intent of the original treaty negotiated in 1840. And the unfortunate thing with what we're seeing now with the proposed voice here is that the real agenda of the people that are pushing this, in fact, is not equality, not closing the gap, but co-governance. And that is very dangerous. It is absolutely vital that we stop this.
Who put the minister, the Maori parliamentarian, at least, up to it? Why would have he known to make these amendments? Was it just something that he took upon himself to think that would favour, as you say, the Maori elite? Or do you think there was something more nefarious actually going on?
Well, if we're going back to the original situation, the original draft of the treaty was prepared in English by Captain Hobson and translated into Maori by long-standing missionaries in New Zealand, but the treaty negotiations and what was signed were in the Maori language. Now, Captain Hobson had a newly appointed and quite inexperienced secretary, James Freeman, who subsequently recast the Maori text into flowery royal-style English for sending to London, and he included in his English so-called translation some key words that weren't in the original in which the treaty was negotiated. And that is the problem. All this is covered in a book which is about to be published by Chris Newman in New Zealand, called Fraud, Plunder, Treason and Our Treaty. And I know about this because I have very recently edited the whole of the book, So I'm reasonably full bottle on what's been happening. But in New Zealand, they're having tremendous problems over ownership of water and taking it away from local councils and giving it to Maori chiefs. And the thing is, it's not benefiting the Maori population in general. It's benefiting the iwi, the chief leaders. And another problem with this is that in New Zealand, although 15% of the population put themselves down as Maori, in fact, there's been so much intermarriage in New Zealand, much more so than has been the case here, that the average percentage of actual Maori blood in Maori New Zealand is about 2%. And for the purposes of the iwi benefiting from the Treaty of Waitangi Act 1975, there is no ancestry standard or test other than self-identification. And that situation is exactly replicated in what's proposed here. And the last thing I'll make on this point is that the current New Zealand Minister for Foreign Affairs is the Maori Nanaia Mahuta, who's pushing this co-governance agenda. And we've done some detailed analysis of her genealogy. And would you believe it? She's 43% English, 6% Irish, so that's pretty well half, 38% Maori, 13% Cook Islander. So she's a half British. And yet she's driving a process for co-governance, and co-governance in fact means that the Maori in New Zealand, the Maori elites only, have a veto over just about everything that's proposed, and that's the agenda that's being pushed here.
You say they've subjected to a test to prove their identity, and you're breaking it down into percentages of where the heritage is actually from, but that's an impossibility in Australia, isn't it? Because I know Alex Antich in particular was before a Senate Estimates Committee asking how one would prove their identification as being Indigenous if they were to vote for this voice, or even indeed try to become a representative for the voice. But that was just shut down. I mean, people couldn't even answer the question. They were too frightened to actually answer the question. So we're actually creating a honeypot, aren't we, where people like Bruce Pascoe is a classic example of it, who wrote Dark Emu, classic example of someone who would want to identify as being Indigenous because it actually services them. It's of some material benefit than not being Indigenous, even though we pretend to continue to play this racist game.
Absolutely. Well, in Australia, of course, we have such things as birth certificates, which supposedly identify the parents, and you should be able to go back quite a long way. Now, in the genuinely traditional Aboriginal areas, of which there are now not all that many, records may not be available that go back very, very far. But in the case of that I gave you from New Zealand, of Nanaia Mahuta, we've done, well, Chris and his team have done research through Ancestry, and the results are quite clear. And a hell of a lot of people that are wanting to jump on this gravy train of privilege, and the ability to plunder the resources of everybody, are fully documented.
I'm interested in what you say, David, about the idea of co-governance. And I know you cite in your article an article written by Janet Albrechtson in The Australian on the 8th of April this year, saying as much. But ultimately, there's no such thing as co-governance, is there? Because you can't have two alternate sources of power. Ultimately, they'll have to coalesce in the same power, or one will dominate the other.
Well, co-governance doesn't mean that you've got two people taking decisions. However, in practice, what it means is the ability to veto whatever is proposed by the elected, by the government that we've all elected, or to impose delays or to second guess what the government's proposals are. What these people are proposing, in fact, is the requirement for the voice, if it's passed, to have its own parallel bureaucracy that parallels all the government departments, and it would have the requirement to be consulted in advance by government on just about anything that it proposes, because in practice, anything that the parliament passes to affect all of us, of course, to some extent, and sometimes even to a large extent, impacts upon Aboriginals and Torres Strait Islanders. And in what Albanese is putting up for us to agree to, there is no spelling out of what issues a voice could be consulted on, and also, of course, in the event that the government or the executive doesn't agree to what the voice is doing, then because the voice has constitutional status, it can challenge legally a government decision, and of course anything that's in the constitution is judiciable by the High Court. And this, you know, in Australia we've suffered for years from far too much red tape. And then of course on top of that we've got green tape, which has amounted to paralysis by analysis, and now black tape would be added to that, which essentially would add huge delays on anything and everything, and in practice could virtually make the country ungovernable.
We're talking to David Truman, who is the director of the Freedom and Heritage Society, in his latest article about The Voice, which is a Trojan horse for co-governance. We're going to go to news and we'll be straight back to talk to David. You're listening to TNT Radio.
And now,
dude, I have huge news.
I knew it! Knew it.
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boyland here with a look at your TNT headlines. Following a days-long manhunt, a man accused of massacring five of his neighbours in Texas, including a mother and her 9-year-old son, has been arrested. People in Amsterdam have taken to the streets to commemorate the dozens of people burned alive by Ukrainian radical nationalists in Odessa 9 years ago. And there are fresh warnings that the US will slip into a recession within weeks if urgent steps aren't taken to avert a crisis.
Free speech is in our DNA.
Experimental vaccines will never change that.
Listen to TNT Radio anywhere you go. Yeah, even there. Never miss out on the news and views of the big issues of the day. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio.
Or download the TNT Radio app for free.
From the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
We're talking to David Truman about the Indigenous voice to Parliament. David, I'll put this to you. I've talked to Josephine Cashman. She's a lawyer and Indigenous spokesperson, and she thinks it's even more diabolical than what we're talking about as, co-governance. She thinks this is implemented by the United Nations through the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples as a means for transnational corporations to ultimately seize control of Australia, its landmass and its mineral wealth. What do you think about that proposition?
Well, there's no doubt about it that the United Nations is being used by nefarious people to reduce to continually reduce national sovereignty. I don't know the extent to which you could say that individuals in the United Nations are so focused on our situation that they've got this specifically in their focus. But I think it is very, very important that we pull back on the extent to which we subject ourselves to governance by people that aren't elected by us. And I think I mean I would agree with Senator Malcolm Roberts and a number of other senators that I respect that we really ought to pull out of the United Nations completely. I mean, its organs are so comprehensively corrupt, and it is pursuing a globalist agenda. You only have to look at speeches that are given by Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General. I mean, he is typical of failed leftist politicians, which the UN is absolutely full of. And, you know, he pushes this, that, and the other scare campaign, whether it's climate change or whatever. And all of these things are being used to kowtow us into accepting external sovereignty over our national sovereignty. It's just not on.
It'd be very difficult for an Australian government to draw a position like that unilaterally, wouldn't it, and decide to pull out of these globalist institutions, as you say, like the United Nations on its own.
Just one small example, UNESCO had us go cap in hand. That's the United Nations Education and Scientific and Cultural Organization, had us go cap in hand to defend oppose the proposition that the Great Barrier Reef was in great danger. And people like Jennifer Marahese and Professor Peter Ridd, formerly of University of James Cook in Queensland, have absolutely blasted this as nonsense. And the point is, how the hell can people from countries like, I don't know, Somalia, Ethiopia, the Arab world and so on, be better placed than we are to know how to manage our own priceless Great Barrier Reef? And I mean, the whole proposition of having to go cap in hand to external forces is utterly ridiculous. I mean, in 1983 we had the Tasmanian Dams case, when a lot of people voted for the Hawke government to try and save the Tasmanian wild rivers from dams,
and Franklin in particular.
Yeah, and the the whole thing went to the High Court, and they ruled 4-3 to uphold the ability of the Commonwealth government to have recourse to the external affairs power to. And the fact that Western Tasmania had been inscribed on the World Heritage as a basis for overruling the Tasmanian state government. Now, apart from the merits of the case as to whether it was a good or a bad thing to dam the rivers, it is utterly absurd, I think, for us to be imposing external non-elected power over what Australians want to do in their own country. I think that was a grievously wrong decision by the High Court.
The globalists have recognised, haven't they, there's a weakness, if you like, a psychological vulnerability in the nation state of Australia. I'd say it'd be the same vulnerability that's in all the frontier cultures, Canada, New Zealand and the US included, and that's the plight of its Indigenous peoples. And they're using that, they're weaponising that psychological vulnerability against us for their own purposes.
Well, yes. It's the situation between different countries like Canada, the United States, Australia, New Zealand is different and has its own quirks, its own peculiarities. But the unfortunate problem for us is that lots of people are being dragooned by the pro-voice, the yes people, to vote not on the basis of careful analysis of what the implications are or what is actually proposed down the track, but to vote out of a warm inner glow of doing what's morally right to help the Aborigines. For goodness sake, I certainly don't disagree with the proposition that we need to do what we can to improve the situation of disadvantaged people in general, including, of course, Aborigines. But this proposal is not going to do that. It's going to advantage. It's going to provide a gravy train for the same political elites who've had their snouts in the trough for decades now. It's 50 years now since Whitlam brought in the whole idea of improving Aboriginals' way of life and so on. And we've spent tens and tens of billions of dollars on doing this. And who's benefited? Not people that are really struggling in the regions and whose kids aren't going to school and all this sort of thing. Not the people that Jacinta Price wants to help, but the elites, the urban, sometimes educated and often self-serving elites. I mean, if you look at ATSIC, it was abolished eventually because of its corruption and inefficiency. And there is no guarantee that the people that will be elected to this voice will be any different.
There's a confluence of attacks on the nation state itself, isn't there, here too? And it's weaponized through mass immigration too. So people come here, they have no necessary, maybe a rudimentary understanding of this country's origins and its heritage. And then they learn through the education system and obviously through the media and all the institutions what a racist and incorrigible past this country has. And ultimately they'll feel, as a minority group themselves, fealty to voting for this indigenous voice, are probably identifying themselves as being like this minority group, depending on particularly on where, what sort of circumstances they've escaped. That's a real problem for us as well, because we don't have a ground to argue against. They're saying, well, this is your culture itself telling us how bad you guys were. So we're really so far behind the eight ball because we never fought the culture wars in the first place.
We do have a leg to stand on, and that is truth. The truth is that all these attacks, this cultural pessimism, which riddles the West, all the countries which at one stage were colonial or imperial powers, are being demonized, and the whole of Western civilization is being rubbished as being something that's been an unalloyed bad. But the fact is that. That no civilization, no country has been or is perfect. Every country's history has warts and all in it. But Western civilization has provided far more benefits in so very many ways than any other civilization in human history. And to say that everything in our history is racism, xenophobia, colonialism, it amounts to nothing more than self-hatred. And it is part of the agenda of cultural Marxism, whose objective is to destroy the institutions and all the institutions and values of Western civilization, starting, of course, with Christianity. But also the family and so many of these things. You know, it's true. So many of our kids in school and in university go and are subjected to vile propaganda from lefties and Marxists and cultural Marxists. And it is to the, in my view, the undying shame of the 9 years of supposedly conservative government federally in Australia that ended last year, that there was virtually no attempt to fight culture war and defend the values of our civilization.
David, thank you. I'll have to pull it up there because I've got another guest, but I thank you so much. We're going to end up being a case of killing the goose that laid the golden egg. David Truman, thanks so much for joining me on the Damien Richardson Show. You're listening to TNT Radio.
A new peer-reviewed scientific paper says the less you know about climate, the more you cry about climate. Oh yes, you'll want to hear this.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
A new peer-reviewed paper called Environmental Knowledge is Inversely Associated with Climate Change Anxiety reveals that the more environmental knowledge you have, the more you worry about the environment. To translate that, the less you know about climate, the more afraid you're going to be. and the more likely you're going to be out spilling paint and defacing works of art and screaming for a climate emergency declaration. Conversely, previous studies have shown that climate skeptics are the most knowledgeable about climate change. So the more you know about climate, the less afraid you are, and the more skeptical you are of claims of a climate crisis. The solution is simple. Investigate climate change. Go to climatedepot.com and learn the true facts. This is Mark Morano for the Morano Minute on TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Researcher William Doyle of the Caesar Rodney Election Research Institute, CRERI, found grants from Zuckerberg's favored nonprofits, the Center for Technology and Civic Life, CTCL, and the Center for Election Innovation and Research, CEIR, rivaled federal and state COVID-related election expenses, with CTCL and CEIR together accounting for an 85% increase in total additional election funding. And that largesse was concentrated in a relatively small number of heavily Democratic municipalities. Both organizations were founded by left-wing activists with ties to top progressive advocacy groups. Although CTCL and CEIR are chartered as non-partisan 501c3 corporations, CRERI research suggests the $419.5 million of CTCL and CEIR spending that took place in 2020 was highly partisan in its distribution and its effects.
If you're talking about it,
the United States of America should never, ever default on its debt.
We're talking about it.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
It's great to welcome back to the show Robin Lamley. She was, she is the current sitting member, independent, representing the division of Araluen in the Northern Territory Legislative Assembly. We spoke to her last week. We wanted to come back on the show, though, because now we're going to talk about the reality on the ground that's actually affecting Indigenous people as we speak. And this is a case of where these foster children are being removed from homes because the law says that Indigenous children have to be cared for where possible by an Indigenous family. So there's these two children specifically removed recently from their non-Indigenous foster family despite being raised by them for over a decade. And they've been rehomed multiple times and into homes that they just didn't want to be in. But it doesn't matter what the child says. One of those children's even said she just wants to be a normal kid. Just leave her alone. I've actually got a grab. We've got an audio grab, which I'm going to go to now, and you can listen to the child speaking for themselves. You are listening to TNT Radio.
They moved me to another house that I don't want to. I don't know why, but they are nice, but I just want to be a normal kid and have a normal life. I just want things to be like the way they were. And I keep telling you guys, I told you on Friday that I don't want to go there, I want to stay with Happy. And they're supposed to listen to me, but I feel like you guys weren't really listening to me.
Hi Robin, welcome back to the show. Can you just tell us what's going on in that grab?
Hi Damien. This is referred to as the kinship care principle, and the premise underlying this is that no matter what, pretty much, Aboriginal children should always be cared for by Aboriginal carers. I live in Alice Springs. I've been a local member here for many years, and I've had many distressed non-Aboriginal foster carers come into my office absolutely destroyed by having a child that they've cared for many years removed under this principle. And it happens very suddenly, sometimes with little to no notice at all. These children are ripped away from their non-Aboriginal foster parents and placed in a kinship care situation. And I think most times it works out okay, but I've also heard some pretty horrific stories of children that have been extremely well cared for by non-Aboriginal foster carers going back into remote communities, which is a totally different cultural experience from living in town, for example, in Alice Springs or Catherine or Tennant Creek or wherever, taken to a remote community, and these kids are just lost and confused. They might be surrounded by their culture and an Aboriginal family, but it is a pretty big change for everyone concerned, and sometimes it doesn't fare well.
When we're being asked in multicultural Australia not to see race or cultural identity at all in most instances, aren't we? Yet that seems to not be the case specifically when it comes to Aboriginal people.
Well, in the Northern Territory, everything is put through the lens of race. And when you live in the Northern Territory as a non-Aboriginal person, you accept that. That's just the way it is. We've 30% of our population in the Northern Territory and in places like Alice Springs, even higher in a town like Tennant Creek, are Aboriginal people. So if you choose to live here, positive discrimination, affirmative action is alive and well with everything, absolutely everything. But sometimes that doesn't work well for the Aboriginal people involved, but that's just the world we live in. And this is a good example how children, and keep in mind, the Northern Territory has always, I've been in the Territory for 30 years, and ever since I can remember, we've always had the highest rate of children in out-of-home care in the country. And most of those kids, I'd say more than 90%, are Aboriginal kids. So we've got this large number of children that require care. They've been taken away from their families because of child abuse and neglect. And sometimes the statutory authority, the Child Protection Authority, just cannot find appropriate Aboriginal carers or kinship carers to look after these kids. Sometimes they have to stay in town because of their medical needs, and the family's all out bush. Sometimes there's just very reasonable explanations as to why the kids can't be with family, but sometimes they just can't find anyone. So, you know, these non-Aboriginal people step up. They're usually incredibly kind, selfless, sometimes, you know, really well-educated, skilled people that just want to love and care for these beautiful children. And the kids get used to living in a certain way. But, you know, the principle, I don't think you can argue with, Damien. You know, Aboriginal people shouldn't be stripped of their cultural identity. But, gee, there's some really stupid decisions made when it comes to kinship caring that I've seen. Some of these decisions lack common sense and good judgment, and that's what that story that you're referring to is all about, a situation where these kids have been ripped away from their non-Aboriginal foster parents and they're not happy.
It's an ideological understanding, though, within the bureaucracy itself, isn't it? Promoted by things, this sort of relentless, uncritical promotion of a putative, stolen generation that were taken from their Indigenous parents and their Indigenous community for no good reasons, for no purpose other than as a vindictive need to make them assimilate to white culture. It seems extraordinary, too, that more often than not, it's those urban mixed race elites in the Aboriginal aristocracy, if you want, that are actually doing well, at least financially, out of a system that's been created in Australia since the colonial arrivals. But this is an ideology that's impossible for the bureaucrats to get past, isn't it? As you actually could work to the detriment of the child you are removing rather than work to your own detriment to not to be seen to be upholding this ideology.
Definitely. And I see evidence of that these children are removed from non-Aboriginal foster parents and placed in a situation in which they're not getting the care and the attention that they've grown up to expect. And, you know, that's sort of a psychological problem for these kids having to adjust. Look, there's a few things that we really cannot get our heads around, I think, as Australians, and particularly in a place like the Northern Territory, that the hangover from the stolen generation, and also for us here, the intervention. It's like we're constantly in this state of shame and guilt, and because of that, some really bad decisions are made. on behalf of Aboriginal people. And one of them, I think, is around how we manage the whole area of child protection. I mean, you know, in Alice Springs, we see children 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 running around the streets at night without adult supervision, and everyone sits back and watches it. If it was my child, me being non-Aboriginal, I would be hauled over the coals and made to account for why I wasn't looking after my children. But in this town and in other places throughout the Northern Territory and in Northern Australia more broadly, this happens on a nightly basis. So there's no equity or rational thinking around how we protect Aboriginal children compared to non-Aboriginal children.
It's like we're removing consequences.
Shame.
Well, it's like we're trying to remove consequences from the Indigenous community because it's too frightened, because there's high Indigenous custody rates, I'm sure, in particularly in communities like Alice Springs, et cetera. And it seems to become part of some national shame. It's almost an intractable problem that we're dealing with, isn't it, ultimately? Like, there's so many well-meaning people from both sides, I'm sure, of the political spectrum, trying to bring about some sort of restitution. But ultimately, nothing seems to make a difference.
It feels intractable, Damien, but if you have courage, then as a leader, I think you can make a difference. Why do we sit back as a community in Alice Springs and watch these small children run around the streets unsupervised by adults at night? I don't think it's rocket science how to address that. It's a child protection issue. You pick these kids up, you take them into a caring situation, you give them a bed and some food, and then the next day you find out who these kids belong to and start that difficult process of trying to ascertain what on earth is happening in this family that children are roaming the streets at night. It's not difficult, but it takes courage. And I think a lot of politicians, particularly when they rely on the Aboriginal vote to get across the line, have no appetite whatsoever to address these difficult issues.
But how do you begin, Robin, to impose responsibility on individuals? And I can talk about my own circumstances, my own issues I had growing up with alcohol in particular. And it wasn't until I took individual responsibility for my circumstances, whatever they were, whether my mother and father were divorced or what other extenuating circumstances, I could always offer up excuses and have well-meaning people listen to it, I'm sure. But ultimately, I had to take responsibility for myself. So how do you begin to say to a group of people, well, you have to take responsibility for yourself. You can't be picking up their kids and taking them into a space and providing for them, and then it's just not practical, is it? Ultimately, it doesn't work. It falls down.
No, it's not sustainable. You're talking about a cultural shift, I think. We don't expect anything from the parents and sometimes the families of these children that are clearly being neglected, if not abused. And I think that comes from the top down. If you start as a government to expect more, then chances are you will get more responsibility or have parents, in this case, behaving more responsibly. I mean, you know, one of the problems we have in Alice Springs and throughout the territory, I mean, it's spread right across the territory now, is purely and simply bad behaviour. Now, how do you fix bad behaviour? It takes so long to change a human being's behaviour, as you describe in your own personal circumstances, but you've got to start somewhere. And I think if a government is not inclined to demand a certain level of behaviour and responsibility, then it will never happen. And I go back to what I said before. It takes courage. Leaders have to be courageous. And when it comes to the race issue, people fold. Leaders fold. People don't know what to say and do. They don't want to be accused of being racist. I've got to a point in my political career where I don't care. I love my community. 30% of my community are Aboriginal. And I'll say things that are difficult to say because I don't really care. And I think people respect me enough to know that I'm doing it out of love and kindness, not because I'm a racist bitch, but because I actually do want to see people change and have a better life. And if they don't believe me, then so be it. But, you know, that takes a certain point in someone's life to get to that, doesn't it? I mean, it's usually a sign of age and maturity and hopefully a bit of wisdom thrown in. But not all leaders have that, Damien.
I'm going to have to finish it up, but I just ask you quickly if you can answer this question. It's unfair to give you this question right at the end, but I saw a live recently of the Alice Springs Mall. It consists of basically a whole lot of empty retail spaces and spaces boarded up because people are just frightened to do business in that community.
Yes, well, we're embattled. The place has deteriorated economically and socially. We are facing a crime crisis, and we have for probably about 4 or 5 years, if the truth be known. So the consequence of all that is that businesses are suffering. Damien?
Robert Lamley, the independent member for Araluen in the Northern Territory, thanks so much for joining me again on the Damien Richardson Show. You're listening to TNT Radio.